This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Kim Phillips Fine is an assistant professor of history at New York University's Gallatin School, where she teaches 20th century American history. Her new book is Invisible Hands, The Making of the Conservative Movement from the New Deal to Reagan. Kim, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. I have really been looking forward to this conversation. It is a fascinating book, and we'll let listeners know that we'll be giving away a copy of the book at the end of the interview, so stay tuned. Tell us first where the book came from. I'm curious what you're working on or discussions you're having in class or your research when you realize that you definitely have a book here.
Well, I think there were a couple of things. First is the book really came from a question or from a problem that I saw in the way that people thought and talked about the conservative movement. I started working on the book in the early 2000s, not long after George Bush won his first election, and I was interested in the way that conservatism was often portrayed as a movement really all about social and cultural politics, and I felt like this how it was seen to be about, you know, the pro-life movement, opposition to gay marriage. And, of course, these are very important parts of what the conservative movement is about, but I felt like they left out the economic side of the right. And in many ways, the economic agenda seemed to me to have been much more successful. You know, we, during the 80s and even during the 90s, during the Clinton years, this kind of belief in the free market had really triumphed in a way that the social agenda hadn't. And so why was it that so much of the writing and in the historical literature, so much of the explanation for the rise of the conservative movement focused on these social and cultural issues and not on the economic side of things? And then second, I think there was in a similar way, we saw this actually very much in the coverage of the 2008 election campaign, a sense of conservatism as a kind of working class movement, a movement of working class white people in particular. And this is, again, there's a certain truth to this, but there is also another side. The reality is that those are not the people who have benefited from the policies of the conservative movement. And there's a kind of, you know, a much more elite group of people who have really done very well in this country since the Reagan years and during the Bush years. And I was interested in whether those people had anything to do with the rise of the rise of conservative politics and the success of this economic agenda that had benefited them so tremendously.
We're talking with historian Kim Phillips Fine. The new book is Invisible Hands. Take us back to FDR and the New Deal. And briefly encapsulate for us where you sort of pinpoint the birth of this movement that paved the way, all the way up to Reagan.
Well, I would say that there was a strong reaction among American business leaders against the New Deal, and especially, the New Deal contained many different political tendencies, many different kinds of initiatives, but they really reacted most strongly against what historians sometimes call the Second New Deal, the set of initiatives that included the creation of Social Security, the Wagner Act, which made it possible and legal for labor unions to organize, and these pieces of legislation were passed in the broader context of social and political upheaval, of a major wave of strikes. And we start to see a very strong reaction by business people against this New Deal politics, this new liberalism taking shape. And in the book, I talk about, during the 30s, they tried a number of different kinds of things. The DuPont brothers, for example, started the American Liberty League, which kind of posed as a populist organization. They claimed that it represents people from all walks of life in their common opposition to the New Deal. In reality, it was tightly controlled and financed by a fairly small group of executives. The DuPonts always plays a very important role. I also talk about people like Leonard Reed, who was a Chamber of Commerce kind of a member of the a representative of the Chamber of Commerce. He worked for the Chamber of Commerce during the 30s, who became deeply opposed to New Deal during the decade and went on to start what's often seen as the first conservative think tank, the Foundation for Economic Education, after World War II. So you have this kind of range of these corporate executives who are very angry about what's happened to the country and who start to believe that they need to take some kind of action to make sure that their views are out there and to use their power to fight back. And they fail during the 30s. I mean, one really important thing about the book is that these people don't always win by any stretch of the imagination. They often fail, but they kind of learn from their failures and go on to keep organizing.
When do you see some of the first major successes of the conservative movement, and why? Why did they happen?
Well, if you talk about labor relations, for example, you actually start to see the kind of cresting, the wave of labor organizing that grew out of the 30s, that gained strength in the 40s with during World War II. And then in the 50s, you start to see the proportion of American workers in labor unions reaches its historic high and then kind of starts to decline afterwards as unions start to run into more opposition and to have more trouble winning elections. And so that actually, I think, is a type of success for these business conservatives, but it comes about long before you have success in electoral politics. And similarly, they start to build kind of an intellectual infrastructure of think tanks, including groups like the American Enterprise Institute, which is still around today. That actually begins in the 40s. It grows during the 50s, and it continues to gain momentum. And so that, too, is, I think, a kind of success in a way, even though it doesn't show up in terms of, winning an election or winning. So I think it's, in some ways, one of the things the book tries to do is look at the infrastructure and the networks that make conservative electoral victories possible ultimately, but before you can have that type of public success, you need to have the creation of this behind the scenes, network or community.
Right, right.
And change in the balance of power in the country.
And that's truly what your book documents, hence the title, Invisible Hands. We're talking with Kim Phillips Fine. The book is Invisible Hands, The Making of the Conservative Movement from the New Deal to Reagan. Just really a fascinating account and very detailed behind-the-scenes story of exactly who was involved in creating this movement, which, as you point out, sort of was born in opposition to FDR's second New Deal. Really fascinating story. Kim, let me ask you this. Explain to us this, as you move forward in history with the New Deal, you see more and more, working blue-class people white-collar folks who sign on to this movement, it becomes incredibly populist. And then you start to see the electoral hot button, gods, gays, guns, abortion. Those really kick in, thanks to, in no small part, to Lee Atwater's electoral politics. And yet, the people who are responsible for creating this movement, because it unarguably is a movement that was created top down, really created by the captains of industry. And literally, the leaders of corporate America gave birth to this thing and funded it. That's really not in dispute. And yet, we see it evolve into an incredibly populist movement. And you can look at the tea parties that took place yesterday that got such a big press. There seems to be some irony there that these people who created the movement would be the least populist people on the American scene. And yet the movement they created has become arguably one of the most populist. Or is it really populist?
That raises the question of what populism really is. And I think conservatives have always, there's always been a funny tension in their politics. You see this actually during the New Deal with a group like the American Liberty League. They can never say, I mean, the people, the conservative businessmen who are behind the American Liberty League can never simply say, hey, we're a bunch of conservative businessmen and we oppose the New Deal. Doing so is totally self-defeating, and it makes them sound like a group of, especially during the Depression, marginal, wealthy people who were simply too selfish and greedy to give up any of their, any of their riches or something like that. So I think they always have to kind of present themselves as populist. So on the one hand, the leaders of this movement all have a very powerful investment all the time in saying, and I think in some ways actually really believe that they represent the true interests of the people, and that ordinary people have been misled by labor leaders or by liberal politicians or by leftists or
the media. Yeah,
yeah, that they've been misled, and if they only could kind of see the truth, they would be conservative. So on the one hand, there's a real interest in putting that out there. Why? I mean, on the other hand, of course, there are some people who are always drawn to, to this kind of politics. And I think, why is that? Well, even why are working class people supportive of an economic agenda that doesn't actually seem to benefit them? I mean, one part of that has definitely been its connection to conservative social issues. But I don't think that's all of it either. I think there is, that a lot of people really do believe that the free market will serve their best interest in the end, that deregulation and taxes are kind of the real problems that they face. And I think, why people believe that is a fascinating question, and it really goes to, I think part of it is that many people actually have no other experience. If you've never been part of a labor union, if you've never been, if you've never kind of, the very paucity of the welfare state in this country kind of helps give credence to those ideas. If you've never had the support of collective social institutions, it's easy to, it's easy to feel as though they're the real problem. I mean, in some ways, being critical of business is always more difficult. It means taking on people who are powerful in your local community. It means kind of challenging something about, the individualist ideology of this country. It's never easy to do that. And the conditions under which people do that are more are unusual, and so I think it's not surprising that as a default position, people kind of accept this conservative economic agenda. That makes sense.
We're
talking about a long-winded way to answer your question.
That's fine.
But
let me ask you before we let you go: you spent years studying this, the conservative movement in America. What is it that you think most people in America today don't know or don't understand about the 20th century conservative movement?
Well, I think most people really don't understand the depth of involvement of this network of conservative business leaders. And I actually believe that the work that I did in the book was kind of just the tip of the iceberg, and that if you had infinite amounts of time, you could develop this even further. I think people really don't understand the extent to which this network of conservative business people, and I, this is not a conspiracy theory or anything. It's they are definitely not all powerful. They face many setbacks, many limits. But I think we don't really think of business as being political in this way. We don't really think of business people as political activists and organizers. And I think, my research shows that they were, and both conservatives and liberals or people on the left need to kind of, address that and think about what it means for their own politics.
Was this a totally new thing in the historical mm-hmm. landscape? I mean, have we seen movements like this in the past, or is there something about this that makes it very new?
We certainly have seen movements like this in the past. I think if you look at the 1890s the politics of the early 20th century, business has always been interested in affecting politics, has always been interested in shaping political life, and has always tried to exert political influence. So in that sense, it's not new. On the other hand, I think the Great Depression and the New Deal really were turning points in American history, and that the kind of political power and social image of American business, which was really very dominant during the 20s, suffered a profound blow during the 30s with the Depression and then with the New Deal. And the organizing efforts that followed those political disasters from the point of view of these business people, they are something new. I mean, I think they represent a kind of mobilizing from a position of weakness in their perspective rather than of unquestioned strength that had been the case before.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think there are other differences too, but that's one important one. So it's funny. In some ways, it's not new. It's old as the hills. On the other hand, there is also, I think, something that is important and different, and that really starts then, and we're still, in some ways, living with today as the debates over the New Deal, you know, the whole question of a new Deal. I mean, these questions are still very much with us.
Absolutely. Kim Phillips Fine teaches 20th century American history at New York University's Gallatin School. Her new book is Invisible Hands, The Making of the Conservative Movement from the New Deal to Reagan. Kim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Fascinating
for having me
book. On. Absolutely. It's a really fascinating book.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit seavillepodcast.com for more.